I indulge tonight in something that I try not to do too often when I'm standing out the front here in church. I let my eyes really roam round the congregation and watch what was going on, because I felt justified in doing that in the light of what I was going to preach on later on. It was good to see my friend Tony, who I had lunch with, and various other people appear in church. Haven't seen him for some time. He tells me he's a champion of individualism, so I thought if I picked him out to mention him, he wouldn't be embarrassed. It was good to see Joe hiding in the background too, but he'll be embarrassed if I mention him, so I won't. I'm quite impressed by the way Fiona sits up there, quite near Noel in the organ, but not actually part of the choir. It's good. It's good just looking around and seeing people, individuals. And I'm glad I'm not preaching just to a congregation. I'm glad you're not just an audience. I would find the whole thing far more formidable. Occasionally I go to meetings when I feel a bit like a speaking machine, as though I'm sort of wheeled in, occasionally fed and watered en route, because that will make me more efficient, and turned on and turned off. But real Christian fellowship and real experience of the church is not like that at all. It's all to do with relationships. Apologies for the first lesson. On the other hand, I think it underlines something that I did want brought out by reading it. If you do read your Bible by yourself, you will know that in the Old Testament especially, you do come across these great lists of names. And very often we just don't mention the subject, as though it's all a bit embarrassing to find these great lists of names in the Bible. So I thought tonight I'd bring them to light. What do we do when we come across a bit like that? I don't think there's a need to read them through every time. But I think one thing we can do is to get a real sense of God as the God of the individual. So many other books to do with movements are all to do with ideas and philosophies. But when we come to the Bible, it is a book that is rooted in real people. And some of those people are quite forgotten and quite unimportant now. Yet in their time, they've been used by God. Because, of course, to God, no individual is unimportant. So when I come across those great lists in the Old Testament, I just let myself reflect on God, the God of the individual, the God who cares for us individually, and how important people are to his purposes. Now here in Romans 16, if you'd like to turn to this, if you haven't already, page 155, New Testament. Here in Romans 16, we come to an equivalent sort of passage in the New Testament, one of these great lists of names that anybody trying to read through inevitably stumbles across with some difficulty. I think I'm bound to as I refer to some of these individuals. But again, the principle is there that people matter to God. And as we read through this chapter in Romans 16, I think we see very clearly levels of relationship. How we relate to God and how we relate to each other as fellow Christians relating to God. And I think I can draw most of these principles out by looking at Phoebe, who's the first character we come across in Romans 16, and by picking out the levels of relationship that I see in her life, and then showing how they also run through the rest of the chapter. I think we can best understand the passage and also relate some of these things to ourselves. So let's have a look at Phoebe and see how she related to God and to fellow Christians. In the first place, Phoebe, you will notice in verse 2, is called a saint. The Christians are called on to receive Phoebe as befits the saints. That is, they are called to receive her as saints themselves, and she is referred to as a saint. Now, centuries of misuse of this word have rather discolored our understanding of the word saint. A saint is no exceptional Christian. As far as the New Testament is concerned, rather, every Christian is a saint. And in fact, when Paul comes to the end of listing all these individuals that he does here in Romans 16, he sums it all up by saying, "Greet all the saints." If you look at the end of verse 15, you'll see that's how he finishes. When he runs out of naming individuals, he includes everybody else in the umbrella title, "The Saints." Greet everybody else, the saints. For a Christian is a saint just because he or she is a Christian. A saint is somebody who is on God's side in life. A saint is somebody who's stepped out of a non-Christian world to become a follower of Jesus Christ. A saint is somebody who's put their faith and their hope and their trust in Jesus. Somebody's repented in their heart over sin and realized they need to be rescued from sin and has committed themselves to Jesus Christ. A saint is somebody who's accepted God's forgiveness for Christ's sake. A saint is somebody who is clean in God's eyes, not because they have achieved great things in life, but because all their confidence and hope is put in Jesus Christ. And so you'll see, when a saint is defined like that, that every true Christian, everybody who's put their faith in Christ, is in reality a saint. Now that means that when we meet other Christians, we can see each other as saints. That doesn't mean that we instantly like every other Christian that we meet. Nor does it mean that we necessarily feel anything special for every other Christian that we meet. But it does mean that we know we have something in common. We're both saints. We both have Jesus Christ in common. We're both depending on him for forgiveness, for helping us through life and for heaven. And we both are separated from the non-Christian world by our faith in Jesus Christ. I think that's good to realize, because one of our problems here in a big church like All Souls is that we can never deeply relate to each other instantly. Very often the people we're sitting next to are total strangers, or they are familiar faces that you've now seen week in, week out, but somehow you've never introduced yourself, and it's all a bit embarrassing to actually admit that you don't know somebody else's name. And somehow our relationships can be very artificial. In fact, somebody said to me the other day that one of the bits in the All Souls services that really embarrass them are when we come to the peace in the communion service, because we turn round and greet each other, but this person said to me, but we don't really know each other. It all seems so artificial and so unnatural. We're trying to turn something on that isn't really there. But if we understand this basis of our relationship as Christians, that we are saints, then we realize that we have got something in common, whether we feel it or not, whether it's instantly obvious or not. And when we turn to greet each other, to take this instance of the communion service, when we turn to greet each other, we greet each other as saints, not necessarily knowing each other deeply or understanding each other at all, but having this in common, that we both are dependent on Jesus Christ for our life. And that gives us a bond which can be built on, and a bond which can be rightly expressed. Even if it's only the formality of a handshake, that is expressing a genuine bond. We are united in Jesus Christ, and we can express it. In the second place, Christians have got a family relationship. You see that Paul refers to Phoebe as his sister, or our sister. That doesn't mean that she was literally like the hypothetical Hazel Panoni, or whoever it was, who John projected might be his sister. Not a literal sister like that. No, this is a spiritual sister. And Phoebe is described as this because she is a child of God. John, in his first letter, sums it up like this. Everyone who loves the parent loves the child. That is so simple. If we really love God, then we will love each other, John says. Now, the family picture of Christian relationships opens up a very warm area of our common experience as Christians. And that's why Paul can speak very warmly of the people he describes in this chapter here. Epaenetus, in verse 5, he calls his beloved Epaenetus. In verse 8, Ampliatus, my beloved in the Lord. And Stachys, in verse 9, my beloved Stachys. Paul talks very warmly of these people because he feels a deep bond towards them. And this deep bond is a family bond. He senses that he is related to them spiritually. Because every Christian who has God the Father in common is related to every other Christian as a brother and as a sister. Now, straight away, this raises some problems. It carries on the problem that I raised in the first section. How do we feel towards our fellow Christians? We don't instantly feel like we do towards a brother or a sister. But the point is that the potential for developing that sort of relationship is there between us as Christians. Now, this potential can't be developed in every situation. We can't develop this feeling with every other Christian. We can recognize that we are brothers and sisters. That's a fact. But some Christians we just never will meet. Other Christians we will come into contact with in such a short way that we can't develop a relationship. But with every Christian that we do meet over a long period, there is the potential of developing the awareness of being brothers and sisters. I'm convinced that that is true. Obviously, personality comes into this. It will be far easier to relate to some Christians quickly than it will to others. But I believe every Christian who's going on with God, as we share with them, as we open up our hearts to them, and as they open up their hearts to us, with every Christian we can sense that we are brothers and sisters. But we can't have this feeling about every Christian in the same way, as I say. The sense of family relationship develops more with some Christians than with others. One good example of this is in verse 13, where Paul refers to Rufus and his mother. And there's a lovely little phrase after Paul talks about Rufus's mother, because he simply adds, "and mine." And one can begin to meditate on why Paul called Rufus's mother his mother. One can see that Rufus's mother might well have been a very homely and loving woman, and when Paul went to stay, she really welcomed him. He could put his feet up, he could relax, he could talk to her, he could have a good meal, he could pour his heart out, and he had a very special relationship with this lady. And he felt that she really was, to him, a spiritual mother. Now, it would be impossible for Paul to have that sort of relationship with all the many friends that he had. So within the Christian family, there were obviously some relationships that were specially developed for him, which he felt very deeply. But as I say, for all of us, there is the potential of feeling our brothers and sisters in the family to whom we're related. Thirdly, Phoebe is introduced as a deaconess of the church. Now, this means that she was a servant, a helper of the church. That doesn't mean she was a flower lady or a cleaner. Sadly, that's how people very rapidly think when we talk about servants of the church. She might have been very good at arranging flowers and quite possibly was quite good at cleaning things. But that is not the core of who she was. She was a helper of people, a servant of people, because the church is people. So Phoebe served people. And this highlights something else about our relationships as Christians. We're called to serve each other. And we're called to serve the church and the gospel. We're fellow servants. You'll find that phrase, fellow worker or fellow servants, comes again throughout this passage. There it is in verse 3, Prissa and Aquila, my fellow workers. In verse 12, Urbanus, fellow worker. And the two Triph twins in verse 12. Those names, incidentally, mean delicate and dainty. So one imagines that they were quite a ladylike couple, and probably they were twins. Very often it was the habit in those days to give twins similar names. And they, this delicate couple, delicate and dainty, were workers, nevertheless, in the Lord. And then, of course, there was Timothy, upon whom Paul depended so much. It's amazing, as Paul pours his heart out throughout his letters, we find he depends so much on his human friends and his human relationships. And he leant so heavily on Timothy. We see it throughout the letters. Timothy, his fellow worker, referred to there in verse 21. As we go on as Christians, I think one of the things that draws us closest is not only the sense that we're all on the same side as saints, not only that we're brothers and sisters, but we're all in the same cause together. That is why I think when people are committed to Jesus and working for Jesus and serving him and serving the church and serving each other, then friendships spring up very deeply. It's sometimes sad to find people who are longing for a deeper experience of Christian fellowship, and they're going around grasping it, trying to find people who will give them more fellowship. Very often that is the wrong way round, because it is as we pull side by side together with the same commitment as servants to the church and to Jesus and to each other that friendship really develops. We're called together to win other people for Christ, to build up Christians, to serve the church. And as we do that, we find that in our working relationship, we're satisfied with a deeper bond that develops between us. Bonds are built sharing in the spiritual battlefield. Phoebe was a servant of the church, and we need to follow her example. And then the last thing about her is that she was also a helper of many. That comes at the end of that first paragraph. A helper of many, as well as of myself. And this simply reminds us that Christian fellowship is very practical and down to earth. It's not something that is just airy-fairy and spiritual. It needs to be rooted in practical help. One can only speculate on how Phoebe had helped many people. Perhaps it was in hospitality, having them to stay. Perhaps it was by her encouragement. Perhaps it was by her advice. Or maybe she had a chariot and a horse and loaned it out, and Christians went trotting around in her chariot and horse. I've no idea how she provided this practical help. But as one looks around the church today, one sees Christians who have this great gift of helping others in a very practical, down-to-earth way. And these are Christians who are greatly valued by Christian workers and by their fellow Christians. Prisca and Aquila were obviously those who were prepared to get stuck in and help Paul practically. We don't know how they risked their necks for him. Obviously, helping Paul for them was a pretty risky business. It needn't be like that for us all, but we need to get stuck in and to be helping fellow Christians practically. Not everyone will be in the same position of Gaius. We read about him in 23. He was a host to the church, and one has some sense there of somebody who was very hospitable, who had perhaps a large house and means financially, because helping people often involves a financial commitment. And here is Gaius, who was in a position to do it. Perhaps he was helped by the fact that he knew Erastus, the city treasurer, but that again is speculative. But these early Christians were practical in the way they helped each other. Now, how much of this is true of us? Have we grasped, first of all, the very basis of our relationship? Not in the first place that we instantly like each other, but that we are saints. Every single one of us is in a totally different category to a non-Christian. We are on the side of God, on the side of Jesus Christ, committed to him and to his gospel. That's the basis of our life. And if only we can begin to share on that level, we will find it is that which unites us in Christ. But we're also brothers and sisters. Our relationship is not just a spiritual thing, wonderful though that is. It is a warm human thing. We are actually related to each other by being related to the one Father. But that must be worked out in practice, in our actual daily Christian relationships. Then we need to be servants of each other, working for Christ, working for our fellow Christians, involved in Christian work. And that too will bring us into a deeper relationship with our fellow Christians. And in the course of helping and serving, we must be practical. We must be a helper to our fellow Christians, involved in practically opening our homes, sharing our money, sharing our transport, visiting people. And in all the many practical ways, this is necessary to help fellow Christians. Then some very brief comments, just secondly, about some of the barriers that I see broken down by the early Christian church, which shine through this chapter. Three in particular. And this is true wherever one opens the New Testament, but it's very obvious here. Take sex discrimination. Sadly, the idea still goes round that Paul was really a bit of a misogynist and took every opportunity to do down women. If you read a chapter like this, it just doesn't come through that Paul was like that at all. Six out of the 24 names mentioned here are women. The one who gets the biggest mention, the one Paul is particularly writing to commend to the church, is of course a lady, Phoebe. There's some other interesting things one can pick out too. I'm going to come back to this later, but it's quite interesting that almost every time Prissa and Aquila come up in the New Testament, Prissa, the lady, is mentioned before Aquila, her husband. We've already looked at Rufus's mother and seen what an important figure she was personally to Paul, somebody who really he could share with, who was a Christian mother to him. And we've looked at the two Triff twins, and there's Mary and there are others too, who are picked out by Paul for their hard work. He recognized that some of the people who were doing key work in the church were the ladies. And we see him relating to them warmly and lovingly. Take class discrimination, another barrier. I've already had it referred to this evening. Some of this is a bit speculative, again, because we can't be sure who all these people mentioned in this chapter are. But it's very interesting how often names like this come up in secular documents, in Roman documents, imperial documents of the time. And we can only, as I say, speculate as to who's who, because these names could refer to a variety of people. But it is interesting that somebody like Aristobulus, that name is found amongst Roman records, and here was somebody who was at court and a grandson of Herod the Great. Or there is Narcissus in verse 11. That name appears in secular history as somebody who's a wealthy freedman of Emperor Tiberius. So here are some very important names, and the families of these names are referred to here, and it is quite likely that people mentioned in this chapter were descendants of quite important Romans. On the other hand, we have a name like Ampliatus in verse 8, and that's a very common slave name. In fact, in the catacombs, there's a tomb being found with the name Ampliatus on it, and he was a slave. Interestingly enough, though, the tomb has been well decorated, and Ampliatus was obviously somebody who was loved and valued very much by the early church. And even if his origins were that of a slave, as a Christian, he was a very important person. And so we see that the barriers of background are broken down very rapidly by the early church. And this is one of the wonderful things that has been true of the Christian faith throughout the centuries and is true in our own society today. Or take spiritual discrimination. And here it's very much marked by its absence. There are no special order in which names of Christians are mentioned. No titles. No bowing to certain people in special ways. In fact, we can hardly pick out what we might in modern terms call the full-time workers. That's an unhelpful term, but those Christians who spent all their time perhaps not doing a secular job but paid by other Christians to get on with Christian work directly, but you can not pick those people out from the others. All flow together. There is no sense of layman and priest at all in this chapter, just fellow Christians, fellow workers, and Paul puts himself happily in the category of those he works alongside. He's no different to them. There are no barriers separating us as Christians. We are all equally important to God and in his service. Well, as I say, some of this chapter has led to arise a lot of speculation about some of the life of the early church. And I thought to close with, I would share some of this with you, because I think it challenges the imagination and gets us excited about Christian relationships. So let's come back to this mystery of Prissa and Aquila. Why is it that so often the lady comes before the man? There could be many possible explanations, but here is one from one commentary. It may be that at some meeting of the Christians, this great Roman lady met Aquila, the humble Jewish tent maker, that the two fell in love, that Christianity destroyed the barriers of race and rank and wealth and birth, and that these two, the Roman aristocrat and the Jewish artisan, were joined forever in Christian love and service. I wonder if that is the reason. Or take Rufus. We've already referred to his mother, but Rufus himself is an interesting character. Because when Mark was writing his gospel, he was writing primarily for the church at Rome. And one of the characters he refers to is the person who carried the cross, Simon of Cyrene. And he mentions in passing that Simon had two sons, Alexander and Rufus. Now one wonders why he would put in an apparently irrelevant bit of information like that, if he didn't think that the people he was writing to would recognize those names, as though he was saying, well, this Simon who carried the cross was the father of, you know, Alexander and Rufus, your friends. Well, again, it might not have been that Rufus, but it's an exciting thought that here is the son of somebody who carried the cross of Jesus. It's easy to romanticize about these names and about the early church, but it's not a bad thing to do that. Isn't one of the exciting things about being a Christian not only our in relationship with God, but what we see God doing in the lives of other people? I think whenever one gets together with a group of Christians and starts to share, and you really ask each other, how did you become a Christian? How did you ever meet up with Christians? The stories that come out are thrilling and exciting. Behind every single one of our lives is an amazing personal story of how we came to faith. And very often, as one's sharing with Christians, these stories begin to cross, and you find somebody met somebody who met somebody that you knew, or they knew, or she knew. And one has a sense of the worldwide Christian family. Names come up in common, incidents come up in common, and the thrill of sharing in what God is doing in building a family for all eternity suddenly begins to come to the fore. I wonder how much sharing at that level we've done with other Christians. Maybe this would partly solve some of our problems with relating to each other in this church. Perhaps you all thought, when Andrew mentioned earlier, that there's going to be an extended time for getting to know each other afterwards. Perhaps you all thought that could be a bit embarrassing. And you all wondered whether tonight wasn't the night to go back and actually have a chance to look at television, which you don't normally do on a Sunday night. Because we do find it difficult, don't we, to relate to each other. We find it difficult to move from the simple sharing of how are you, how's it going, down to the spiritual. And sometimes we need to plunge in and just ask each other something about our own spiritual adventure, the romantic story of how each one of us became a Christian. Because it is romantic, it is exciting. On the other hand, it would be a shame if we simply became nostalgic as Christians, if we all sat round sharing the wonderful story of how each one of us became a Christian and of what God has done in the past. And as I meditated on this chapter, I became excited again to see what God is going to do in the future. Here's just one little segment of what was going on in the early church, an exciting list of friends and relationships and workers, people committed to Christ, committed to each other, involved in pioneering the gospel. This story has been repeated millions and millions of times throughout the world and is going on being repeated. Now, what has God got in store for us in the future? What relationships as Christians has he got round the corner for us? What saint, brother or sister or spiritual mother, to stretch us as a person, to develop us as a Christian, to lead us on deeper into the knowledge of God? What is round the corner for us as a Christian? Are we going to miss the relationship simply because we're not open? Not open to God, who's prompting us to get to know some other Christian? Not open to other Christians because we are satisfied with the little relationships, the fellowship group, the circle of Christians that we're in already? Are we open to God's adventure, to God's relationships, to those he has around the corner for us? Who is God calling us to serve? What non-Christian is God calling us to reach out to? Perhaps share with some of our Christian friends in going out to reach some non-Christians, and together as Christian servants, as fellow workers yoked together under Jesus, to bring them to church, to a fellowship group, just into our circle of friendship, so they too can be one for Christ What young Christian, needy Christian, is God calling us to serve, to support, to help, to teach, to encourage, to challenge? What has God got in store? Do you get excited by this thought, by the thrill and the adventure of being somebody that God is using in an eternal purpose to build an eternal family, to build an eternal church? It's an exciting and thrilling story that has to be earthed in our everyday life, in our relationships. For these people we're going to come across at work and in our fellowship groups and in the different places and the different churches that God takes us to as Christians, we may simply bump into these people on a train or a boat. I remember that just before I took on my first job, going across to the continent to have a holiday to pray to God about guidance about my very first parish. On the boat, I met up with a group of young people who were for part of a choir who were going to Czechoslovakia. I got talking to them and I discovered that they were from the very area, the very parish that I was going to serve as in my first curacy. And those relationships that I met on, the people I met on the boat crossing the channel, became the foundation of a group of friends who started the youth group in my first parish. One never knows how God's going to open the doors, how the relationships are going to come, but we must be open to Him and to each other, and the adventure will get more and more exciting. Let's just be quiet and pray. Father, thank you for the deepest bond in life, that of being saints, belonging to Jesus. Thank you that this is a family bond. Help us to develop the sense of family practically in our relationships. Teach us to be workers together. Teach us to help each other. And open up for each of us the next step in the adventure of living in your family and serving you and helping others. Thank you for the vista of relationships that opens up to us through your word. Lead us into your next step for our experience of these relationships. Amen.